It's so nice to be living here in the Shire, far away from the coronavirus and government lockdowns. From our hobbit hole near the picturesque windmill, I can see the tiny gentle hobbits frolicking in the sunshine. The hobbit farmers with their hoes and their radish patches, the children running. Out here on the side of a green gentle hill, I've been reading the old philosophers, Plato, Aristotle, Seneca the Stoic, on the nature of fear. But the Shire isn't afraid. We're so far away from the political strife and those coronavirus lockdowns by politicians who push down on the Bill of Rights, even as those same politicians and their families violate the rules. And the people find the rules confusing and worse. They see it as government by whim and get restless and begin to push back. We have no such problems here. We have no Governor Commodius Maximus telling the hobbits that the Bill of Rights is ideology. The only problem I can see here is getting liver sausage. Some columnist at the Chicago Tribune wrote an absurd love song to liver sausage, and now there's been a run on the wonderful, tasty stuff. In Chicago, a Cook County commissioner sent me a letter to tell me that the red apple on Clark Street was out. My friend Kristen tells me that her store was out on the south side. And even Casey's Market in Western Springs was out of it on Saturday. These outlanders are driving into the Shire to get it. Here in the Shire, we're happy. We live equally, go barefoot in the sunshine with plenty of strong leaf to smoke and ale to drink. But I'd like some liver sausage, damn it. And here's another great thing about my new home in the Shire. The hobbits do not use email. They do not provoke, insult, and swear at journalists. Did you hear what happened to WGN-TV's Ben Bradley, a friend of this podcast, the other day? He dared report on the facts on the ground in Chicago about all those emergency coronavirus hospitals that the feds built for the terrified Governor Commodius Maximus. That 3,000-bed McCormick Place hospital is empty. According to my paper, the Chicago Tribune, Dr. Turkle, the executive director of McCormick Place, the alternative care site, declined to say how many patients were there on Friday. Really? He declined to say. Okay. Governor Pritzker was also very excited after days and days of shrieking that he needed that 3,000-bed facility at McCormick Place. And when it was finally built, he said in a Ben Bradley story, "This is Illinois." But then Bradley started digging. And he reported on WGN the other day that there are only a handful of patients at McCormick Place and at the other emergency hospitals. Imagine that. And at McCormick Place, they've spent $500,000 on 800 iPhones that they won't even use. So what happened to our friend Ben? A human, you know, people that wear shoes. A human wrote him a nasty email. He read it aloud on the Rokan show.
The kind viewer wrote, "Had this extra hospital capacity not been built and those 29 patients had been parked in hallways, folks would have their hair on fire. Why weren't those field hospitals built? F*** you, fat ass, out of touch, elitist fuckface." My response, "Thanks for taking the time to write. Just to clarify, am I the fat ass, out of touch, elitist fuckface to which you are referring? I'm confused. We report on the cost of road construction projects all the time. Why wouldn't we report on the cost of McCormick Place? After all, it's our money." Viewer, "You, Porky, I don't give a f*** about how much of my money goes to keep people safe and healthy. Get ready, asshat, and do better."
You know something, Ben? Hobbits don't swear like that at reporters. That's why I love living here. Hobbits are well-spoken. And if you don't like reporting and analysis and focus on what's not only what's said, but what the politicos avoid saying, then you know what? You're probably in the wrong place. The great Tom Bevan boss and co-founder of Real Clear Politics, that superb website. RealClearPolitics.com is here, and he's the host of the Tom Bevin Show on WOS Radio. We're going to talk to him about two amazing stories that, if not for coronavirus, would be all over the media. The first is that media political double standard involving presumptive Democratic presidential candidate Joe Biden and the allegations of sexual assault, and how the Democrats and their media handmaidens sought to destroy Supreme Court Justice Brett Kavanaugh. Well, let's see. Biden's a Democrat, Kavanaugh was a Republican. Is that all there is? What does that tell us about our country? We'll also talk about the disintegration of Jim Comey's reputation and the collapse of the FBI case against General Michael Flynn. Media is showing an appalling lack of curiosity over how journalists may have been willingly manipulated in the takedown of the Trump White House and that Trump-Russia collusion theory that fell apart. Not all journalists, not reporters here in Chicago. I learned my lesson. I'm not talking about reporters in Chicago. And I'm not talking about reporters who cover, you know, shoe leather stuff in New York or in Washington. But I'm talking about the Washington Beltway pundits, you know, especially the ones on TV. And the print guys that stage musical reviews where they sing and dance for politicians at various dinners, like the Gridiron Club. We'll also talk to Bevin about a fascinating civics project running in Real Clear Politics, and I think it's most important to teach Americans what they've been told to forget, or at least encouraged to forget, about how they're governed. Co-host and my friend Jeff Carlin, executive producer of the Rokon Show, is here, as always. And if we sound halfway decent, it's because Jeff has made it so. And I'm John Cass, husband, father, syndicated columnist at the Chicago Tribune, member of its editorial board, sitting out here in the Shire. And you, so sick of your coronavirus shutdown and your prudent coronavirus concern, and you don't want to get sick and you don't want to infect others, but you're also getting tired of kneeling to government whim. Where are you? You're on the Chicago Way on WGN Plus.
Look, the Chicago Way is a deep cultural phenomenon.
In a tower by the river, there lived a man. There was a man who took a stand with pen and paper in his hand, defeating foes in every ward with a pen more mighty than the sword. No escape from his ink lasso. In a tower by the river, Castle.
Here's how you get him. He pulls a knife, you pull a gun. He sends one of yours to the hospital, you send one of his to the morgue. That's the Chicago Way.
We're talking with
Debbie.
Debbie, where are you from?
South San Francisco.
South San Francisco. And you're a citizen of the United States?
I sure am.
Born here?
Sure was.
What country did we fight in the Revolutionary War?
France.
Mm-hmm. What does the Emancipation Proclamation mean? What did it do? The Emancipation Proclamation. What did it do?
I don't know.
You've heard of it?
I have heard of it.
Freed the slaves.
It did. Yes, that's what it did.
If the president and the vice president died, who would then become president?
The Secretary of State.
No.
Yeah.
No.
Yeah.
No. I'm sorry.
Yeah.
No.
Does the First Amendment and the Bill of Rights seem as if they're under, not seem, they are under assault from various local politicians who are feeling their oats at coronavirus? I thought it was important to talk to you and to interview Tom Bevin, co-founder and president of Real Clear Politics. We'll talk to him about the Flynn investigation and the New York Times and Washington Post's lack of curiosity about what is happening there and how it's all falling apart and what it means to their reporting that won them Pulitzer Prizes. But I first want to talk to you about the 1776 project. I can't think of a more important click that you could do on your computer screen than click on 1776, because, at RealClear, because the New York Times has just won Pulitzer Prize for its 1619 project. I would call this the Pulitzer Prize for Newspeak, as the New York Times erases history and supplants a different type of history that they want and pushes it in the schools and everywhere else. Tom Bevan, Real Clear Politics, why are you promoting and building this 1776 project?
Well, thanks for having me on, John. It's great to talk to you. And thanks for focusing on this. I mean, I think it's really important. I can't take credit for this. This was a brainchild of David DeRozier, who's our publisher, who had this idea as the 1619 project, as you mentioned, was taking off and receiving all these accolades and then being adopted by local school boards around the country to be effectively injected into classrooms, that this is the new narrative for America, that it was founded on the idea that it was about expansion of slavery, and that was the fundamental premise of the founding of the country. And we started to see, you know, some very prominent historians speak up and say, you know what, that's actually not true. It's actually the opposite of what the founders intended, and the spirit, if albeit not the letter, right, of the Constitution and the Bill of Rights at the time. But the idea was that to give voice to and a platform to these folks who were basically pushing back against the 1619 Project. And so that's what we've done. I think it is really important. And we've run a couple of different essays on it. They've been really, really good in terms of their sort of taking a 30,000-foot view of the founding of the country. And as you mentioned, I mean, just yesterday, Nicole Hannah Jones, and interesting to note too, John, that the New York Times did not win the Pulitzer for reporting. They didn't win it for, any sort of special citation. They won it for a single essay that was in the commentary section, right, by Nicole Hannah Jones. She was the one who sort of supervised the whole project, and she wrote the introductory essay. But it might be the first time ever, John, that a Pulitzer Prize has been given to an organization for a piece of work that merited basically a correction that undermined almost the entire premise of the piece. I mean, the New York Times has since had to correct this idea that the entire, you know, the country was basically founded on the idea that all the founders wanted to promote slavery, and that's why they left Britain in the first place. And it's absolutely not true.
The premise of the Pulitzer Prize winning commentary, as someone who's been a finalist, and I don't think I'll ever win it, Tom. Okay. I'm not in the club.
Carl, why haven't you won a Pulitzer yet? Carl Cannon is one of the best, and I would put you in that category too, one of the great American voices in terms of journalism and essayists and commentary. I think Carl may go unrecognized as well. And it's a shame, because I think the Pulitzers have basically become this sort of clubby thing where liberals all give liberals awards about their liberal commentary and their liberal cartoons and their, you know, all of their, right, all of the liberal work that they produce over the course of a year. And then they, you know, pat each other on the back and move on. I mean, it's become almost a parody of what it was intended to be, which is the idea of promoting this, you know, sort of real thoughtful, explanatory, investigative journalism and commentary.
Well, then I'm not really complaining, because now after what they've done, I wouldn't ever accept it. But but it really is, what they're doing is they're pushing what Orwell wrote about in 1984, which is newspeak. This is newspeak defined. The elimination of history and the imposition of a different history to fit the preconceived notions of the cultural masters of the period. And I find it to be, especially now, you know, that stuff that we ran at the beginning of this interview from Jay Leno and Americans totally unable to understand their own government is bad enough in times of coronavirus. And now we're seeing the club of journalists, the palace guards of journalism, that's what they become, the palace guards of the state, congratulating themselves at the expense of, you know, who cares about, I mean, Carl Cannon to me is one of the best, and I'm not, but that's not as important as the fact that the Bill of Rights and our freedoms are under assault right now, and we don't know why or how these things are done. That's why I think your 1776 project on Real Clear is just outstanding and important.
Well, I appreciate that. I mean, look, there are two issues that sort of have blended together. One is that we don't teach American civics anymore. We've gotten away from that as a country in our public school and our education system. And that's been happening for decades, right? People no longer understand. They don't understand civics. They don't understand the founding of the country, how it works. And Jay Leno used to get a good chuckle out of that by going on the street and asking people basically the same questions that people who emigrate to America have to answer on their citizenship test, right? And our own
questions my dad was asked.
So, right. So that's one issue. And then the second issue is the sort of the takeover of political correctness and identity politics, which bubbled up through journalism, but also our universities, and produced an entire generation of folks who then went on to teach at public schools and colleges that promote everything through, right, this identity politics lens and this hierarchy of victimhood. And so, you know, consequently, we can't talk about, you know, Columbus anymore. We can't talk about some of the founders because they're seen as being oppressive, patriarchy, white privileged males. We can't read certain books. We can't listen to certain music. We can't, you know, all these things have become verboten to a certain degree. And instead, we're promoting things like, and I'm not saying that, you know, Black history, for example, isn't an important thing, shouldn't be talked about and in the context of it's not like we should gloss over slavery or any of these things.
Of course not.
But of course not, right? But instead, what's happened is this, and Nicole Hannah-Jones and what the 1619 Project has done is basically take history and turn it on its head, looking through this prism and basically saying, look, slavery was part of our DNA. It is now at our core, the core founding of the country, and this is why we have all these problems in America today. And I just think to your point, it's Orwellian. It's fundamentally, you know, I think dishonest to a certain degree. And it certainly doesn't incorporate the broader history of the country to get to the point where we are right now. I mean, if you read these essays, you read the 1619 Project, I think you walk away feeling like, and this is sort of this is sort of the progressive mindset that America is not exceptional. It's not that great of a country. In fact, from its core, it's flawed, and in some ways it's evil and needs to be corrected. And we've gotten it wrong the entire time, when I think most folks in America feel exactly the opposite about that. And at the very least, there should be a sort of balanced discussion about the flaws of America, but also where we've come. I mean, you look at our country in the broad landscape of the globe, we are the biggest, most progressive, most pluralistic, most free, most diverse society in the history of the world. And do we still have problems? Yes. But have we made massive improvements in our society over the course of, you know, 220 plus years? Of course we have. And it's right to acknowledge those. So
it's the beauty of our nation and of our Constitution is that when it was, though it was written in large part by slaveholders and slave owners, even they understood the intellectual path that they were taking. And it, ultimately, it took us through from 1776 to 1863 to Pennsylvania, where Union soldiers had their intestines eaten while they were alive, wounded in the Battle of Gettysburg, and so much more. So, yes, there is racism, and racism is stupid and projected by stupid people. But the country has been working mightily to reach its ideals. And at the time when we are reaching them to have this nonsense supported by the Pulitzers and therefore seen as truth is just depressing.
And John, on that point, I mean, they do give a Pulitzer for fiction. This could have easily fallen into that category. I mean,
After the corrections, right, Jeff?
Right. And the craziest thing, I think, you talk about the revisionist history and the idea that, you know, this is what we think, you know, and we're looking backwards. But at the time, you know, there was no slavery was a commodity. It was a part of life. It was a throughout not just that time, but history all the way back to people living in stone huts. I mean, this is, they're completely misconstruing society at the time. It wasn't this idea, well, you know, we're doing this horrible thing, but it's really good for us. It was, no, this is what we do. The dominators, the conquerors, this is the spoil. You get free labor if you conquer somebody else. That was it.
Well, but weren't the abolitionists, Tom and Jeff, weren't the abolitionists, the northern abolitionists, weren't they part of the American experience as well?
Absolutely. I mean, those two points are critical. Number one, slavery had been around long before, for millennia before the United States. And this makes it sound like, you know, we invented it in 1619. So, right. Number one, it's been around for millennia. Number two, the abolitionists were a huge part of the Revolution and of the Declaration of Independence and the Bill of Rights and the Constitution. And yes, there were men, obviously, who were slaveholders who wrote those documents. But to sort of wave away the abolitionists and airbrush them out of history and suggest that they, you know, didn't exist or didn't have a prominent voice in this is, but one of the things that, you know, when I studied at Princeton, I wrote my thesis on the U.S. Civil War, and my professor, not my thesis advisor, but my professor for one of my Civil War classes was James McPherson, who's a Pulitzer Prize winner, John, author of Battle Cry of Freedom and a bunch of other historical books. He's one of the ones who actually came out against the 1619 Project and said, look, this is absolutely not this is not factual. This is not what happened. This is a distorted view of history. And so he was among those who really spurred us on to produce the 1776 Project in the first place.
The blogger and Christian Rod Dreher, an American conservative, is writing about this as we speak, and so many others. And I want to bring Newspeak to the present day, not just the New York Times, orgy of self-gratification, but the shutdowns and the protests in states against the shutdowns. I see that in Illinois, because one person carried a sign that said in German, freedom through work, one idiotic person, that the entire movement of protests has been relegated by many journalists to be just the work of Nazis. And I find this to be, one, stupid, but two, an almost active participation as guardians of state authority versus liberty. How do you see it?
I agree. I was actually fairly offended by Gretchen Whitmer, who was on one of the Sunday shows with Jake Tapper, and suggested that she said, look, you know, these people that were at the Capitol. And by the way, Jake Tapper's setup question was, you know, quoting someone saying, hey, aren't these protesters, you know, they're likened to the folks at Charlottesville. And she was like, yeah, Jake, that's exactly right. So the setup and the question, I thought, was dishonest and disingenuous. But her answer was even worse, saying, well, it represented, you know, these the worst parts of our country, these racism, there were Confederate flags, there were nooses, there were swastikas. I mean, she made it out to be this horrible thing. I went back because I saw pictures that accompanied the stories when the protests in Lansing happened last week. I went back and looked. I could not find a single Confederate flag. I could not find a single noose. Carl Cannon said he found someone had a noose that they had like a Barbie doll in it or something. I mean, just sort of silly.
Yep. Right.
There were a lot of American flags. There were Don't Tread on Me flags. There were original flags from the 13 colonies. There was one picture of a woman holding a sign that had a swastika, and it said Heil Hitler. She was making fun of and mocking the governor herself for her restrictive stay-at-home orders. So the entire premise of what she said, she just smeared this entire group of people, folks from, you know, Michigan, who are exercising their First Amendment rights. And I thought it was really – and, of course, it goes – you know, Jake Tapper doesn't say anything. It goes unnoticed. It goes unremarked upon. She gets away with it. And I think we're seeing similar things in other states. I mean, I tweeted out this clip of J.B. Pritzker, which I had actually missed from his press conference on Friday, where he was asked by a reporter about his wife and daughter and whether they had engaged in any non-essential travel and whether they were using taxpayer funds or had, security that were paid for by taxpayers. And he said,
well, first of all, I want to say that in politics, it used to be that we kept our families out of it. You know, my official duties have nothing to do with my family. So I'm just not going to answer that question. It's inappropriate. And I find it reprehensible, honestly, that reporter wrote a story about it.
Now, to me, that is just the height of arrogance and hypocrisy for him to sit there while his wife and daughter are reportedly at their equestrian estate in South Florida. And, you know, the rest of us are stuck at home. And there are plenty of examples. I mean, our mayor did the same thing where she basically said, we're going to lock you up, stop acting like criminals. If only she took that same sort of attitude toward killing people with guns and selling drugs and doing all sorts of other things on the South Side.
Right.
So I think there are myriad examples of where, you know, I think folks are, quite frankly, they're not acquitting themselves well in terms of civil liberties and their attitudes and the way that they're approaching this.
But you know what, Tom, what strikes me that Tapper and other journalists, and I'm one, obviously, that there's a lack of curiosity, that there's a edict from the state and some sort of rationale, angry and in sort of a cult of personality style delivery, and they just meekly accept it. And in some respects, I see the same thing happening over the past 3 years with this Russia collusion thing. And now I see it collapsing. And again, the New York, Real Clear Politics had a great essay from Tom Kuntz, the former editor at the New York Times, and it was titled, "The New York Times Used to Correct Its Whoppers, But Not These Two." He talked about the 6019 Project, which is basically, as I said, newspeak, and the attitude of the Times, and I suppose the Post and the rest of the Beltway establishment, to the Pulitzers that they won a couple of years ago. Basically denouncing Trump as an agent of Putin, and now are totally not curious as the Flynn case, which is the predicate of it all, begins to unravel. I find it to be depressing as to the state of
Journalism. There's a big sigh there, John.
Well, yeah, I mean, because journalists, the myth of journalism is that we're iconoclastic. But in reality, what I'm seeing from all these different aspects is that we become woke warriors and guardians of the state against the liberty of the people.
I think that is in some ways true. I mean, look, we've become more divided as a country over time. That's been a trend that's been happening for a long, long time. And it certainly seems we've known the media has been very liberal for some period of time. And I think Donald Trump's, you know, his victory in 2016, it in many ways presented a real, you know, threat. And folks on the left, including folks in the press, I mean, just took an entirely new approach to covering him than they had with folks in the past. And it was made even more dramatic by coming off the 8 years of Obama, where they really, you know, allowed him to you know, get away with
manipulate them,
saying he read things in the newspapers and all that stuff.
I mean, right.
I remember all that. Right. And he, not a hint of scandal during the Obama years. Right.
Right. Exactly.
So look, I think that is true. And Carl and I talk about this a lot. I mean, it used to be, and Carl finds himself in a, you know, Carl's a very intellectually consistent guy, and he does not go with the partisan flow. And, you know, he's been against the FBI and the CIA for a long time. I mean, he's written repeatedly about Bob Mueller and James Comey and how they've abused their powers as FBI directors, and they screwed up different cases, and how'd they get this reputation for being these straight shooters. Suddenly you have, and it used to be liberals were very skeptical and critical of the FBI and the CIA and the intelligence services and the things that they were doing in America, around the world, et cetera, et cetera. And now the left and the press are very much, you know, we got to believe the CIA and the FBI, and they're getting all these leaks from them, and they're printing anything. I mean, literally anything from any source, you know, anonymous, single source, you name it. If they get it from the intelligence services, it goes directly into their papers and becomes another data point, you know, connect the dots in the Russia collusion hoax, that whole thing. And that's been going on for years now. And it is a real departure from where I think people who see themselves, as I think you do, and Carl certainly does, and I do to a certain degree, as civil libertarians and really are wary of, you know, enormous state power and all of these different things. It's disconcerting. It's frightening. And especially when you see now, when it becomes sort of the curtain gets pulled back and you see the abuses that were done to a guy like Michael Flynn. And I know the Obama administration and folks on the left, I've talked to some of these folks, they hated Michael Flynn. I mean, they just hated him. They thought he was a terrible person, evil man, despite the fact that he served his country honorably for all those years.
And I didn't like the fact that he was accepting money to advise Turkey while
that's
he
right.
was
I mean, he was doing, advisor. Yes, he was, yes, he was
I don't like that, but there was nothing, at that time, there was nothing illegal about it, and the imposition of the Logan Act is ridiculous. It correct. Was all designed to get him out of the way so that they could pursue a Chicago-way takedown of the president. And whether you loathe Trump or not, the point being, the secret police is not the agency to get rid of people that they don't like.
Right. And you would think that would be a story that that some young enterprising journalist would think, ah, now that's one that could actually win a Pulitzer. but they would be more interested in it. And it's just, you know, Kayleigh McEnany's first press briefing the other day. I mean, it was an interesting exchange where, you know, John Kral asked this question about Michael Flynn, like, didn't he still lie to the president? And she was just kind of like, what, you know, I'll turn the question back around on you. Shouldn't this bother you? Shouldn't you be interested in this? Shouldn't this be a story? And I thought I thought she was actually exactly right to sort of chastise the journalist, because this is a huge story. If you can manage to strip the partisan aspects away from it and just take it on the merits that one of our intelligence services basically schemed, okay, to trap an individual in an administration, an incoming administration, into a crime, and kept the investigation open even after the agents themselves said that they didn't think he lied and they wanted to close the investigation, which to me is the most damning point of all. That should be alarming to every single American, because if they can do it to Michael Flynn, they can certainly do it to you or I.
And if I may, I'd like to read just a few sentences from Real Clear Politics, Tom Kuntz's essay on media, New York Times, and this. And you can find it, just Google Tom Kuntz, K-U-N-Z, Real Clear Politics, New York Times, and you'll find it. Here's the quote. Just this month, when the Times reported newly declassified material showing that the FBI had been told that the Steele dossier may have been seeded with Russian disinformation, it did not remind readers that it too, had been fed the dossier by Fusion GPS. And the new article mentioned not a word of an unredactable footnote showing Fusion co-founder Glenn Simpson acknowledging to the Justice Department in late 2016 of December, around the time he says he first passed the dossier to the New York Times, that his document, unquote, relied on Russian intelligence service agents, quote, central in connecting Trump to Russia. Now, when I don't write what the motivations of sources are, I find that I'm lying to my readers, which I don't do. Maybe some of them want me to lie to them, but I just refuse. I always say, Tom, that what's not said, the negative space, the silence, is the story. And to me, that kind of thing where you know every detail and you leave certain details out because they're troubling or problematic for your position, I find to be the true sin of journalism as it loves itself with the Pulitzer Prizes.
Yeah, I mean, I agree, generally speaking. I mean, I do think we will look back on the whole Russia, collusion theory, effort, hoax, whatever you want to call it. And if you did a detailed analysis of the media and the way that they handled that and the way that they printed things, I mean, it was just a frenzy. And they basically sort of cast the traditional journalism handbook aside in many respects, in many instances, about, sourcing and disclosure and all of these things, fact-checking, and because they were all so desperate to move the ball down the field an inch and around every corner, everything, fit this prepackaged narrative. And the mistakes were always in the same direction. There was never a mistake that exonerated Trump or anybody involved. I mean, it's
well, when we close, I'd like you to play editor because I think you're a good editor, at least for me, when I talk to you about stuff and how to think of it. How do you assess all that we've said about the Trump-Russia collusion and the lack of curiosity by the Beltway media, and the differences in approach between Brett Kavanaugh and Joe Biden when it comes to allegations of sexual assault? Is there some Venn diagram that you can figure out for me? Because I'm trying to work this problem.
Venn diagram. Well, of course. I mean, it's another example of how the media, I think, is broken. I mean, they're just broken. The way that the media, rushed forth to print any and all, I mean, and devoted inordinate amount of resources, right? Reporters, dozens of reporters from the Washington Post, the New York Times, and Wall Street Journal, everywhere, were digging through Brett Kavanaugh's, yearbook and talking to his classmates, and they were crawling all over Washington and Georgetown Prep and Yale and every place, right? And basically printing, in a lot of respects, outrageously unsourced claims that did not hold up to any scrutiny whatsoever. And then you look, fast forward, you got a claim against Joe Biden. It took 5 weeks for a reporter to ask him, a journalist to ask him about that directly. He did 19 interviews where he was not asked about that claim. You had the New York Times, who basically dipped their toe in the water and wrote a story which cast a lot of doubt and really framed it in a way that, like, well, it's a he said, she said, and there's not any corroborating evidence, and there's no pattern of conduct by Biden that the Biden campaign then took and dishonestly used as talking points for full exoneration. So I feel like the media has fallen down on the job again because too many folks in the media have these prepackaged narratives. One of the worst abuses, John, in my opinion, too, over the last few years, where you have the media running with a story because it fits a prepackaged narrative, and they get bullied into it by these folks on Twitter, you know, the blue check marks, is the Covington Catholic kids. And the way that that whole thing went down was a rush to judgment because they thought, you know, they saw this clip of this video and assumed that they knew what had happened when they didn't, and they weren't curious enough to go actually figure it out before rushing to print with stuff that was tearing up the internet. So I think, you know, taking a step back, you look at these different cases, I mean, I just think the media is broken. It's fundamentally broken. I don't know how to fix it. We're seeing a fracturing of media, and Trump's right in the middle of it, calling everybody fake news, even when stories aren't fake.
Are real.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, he's really, the media has allowed him now to just sort of bulldoze them with this fake news claim. And, you know, they get 99 stories right, let's say, and they get one story wrong. It was the Politico story on China, Trump owing China, you know, $20 million or something. It was a big blockbuster, which they effectively had to retract because they didn't even ask the bank before they ran the story about whether it was true or not.
Right.
So they end up with egg on their face, and nobody trusts the media because it's, you know, all fake news. And so.
But the problem, Tom, is that, yes, we understand that propagandists and useful idiots are the first. When the real lefties take over, the useful idiots are lined up and dispatched. That's how revolutions work. But in the meantime, before that happens, we have a crisis called coronavirus at a time when at least half the country, if not more, probably all of them, depending on their point of view, don't trust the information that they're being given or presented to them by journalists.
Yeah.
And that's a serious problem.
Sir. Serious problem, and it's not an easy one to fix because in some respects that horse is left the barn.
Well, the Zeus the Wonder Dog is barking, and I know you have to go. So I will say again, thanks for the 1776 Project. Thanks for everything on realclearpolitics.com. And thanks for being here on the Chicago Way.
Bye, guys.
You know another nice thing about the Shire? The hobbits here know how to live. They don't read Seneca, and they're not all that stoic, but they're the plain salt-of-the-earth people with plucky hearts. And down at the quaint alehouse, as we smoke our pipes and debate all things, from when it's best to plant the tomatoes and how best to cure a good ham and how to live, I read them this from Seneca.
We suffer more from imagination than from reality. You want to live, but do you know how to live? You are scared of dying, and tell me, is the kind of life you lead really any different from being dead?
And after I read that, one old hobbit, you know, stood up and slapped his little hobbit hand on the table and took a big swig and stared at me. We're all going to die, he said. Will you please stop worrying about it? You can act like a man and just plant your tomatoes. Now, many of you are asking me on Twitter and social media and sending me emails and letters. You're asking, just where is this Shire that Betty and I have moved to? A reader, Kathy Ahern, tweeted, where is the windmill? In or out of the land of Lincoln? Some say that the Shire is in Geneva. Others got on and tweeted that they think it's Hinsdale. And others think it's Indiana because there are windmills in Indiana. I may have said windmills in Indiana, but those aren't the windmills I'm talking about. Those giant steel structures. That's commerce. I'm talking about a quaint windmill. And others say I live in Wisconsin or some luxury condo downtown. Wrong, wrong, wrong. Keep guessing. And when you're right, I'll tell you. But for now, for Ben Bradley of WGN News, for Tom Bevin, co-founder and president of Real Clear Politics and the Tom Bevin Show on WLS, for my friend Jeff Carlin, executive producer of the Rokan Show on WGN, And for me, John Cass, husband, father, columnist for the Chicago Tribune, member of its editorial board. And until next time, on another edition of the Chicago Way podcast on WGN+.